Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Of course, we Zoom on Sunday. I think Dragon just landed in the water and looked amazing. And that means that we will not be discussing anything that happens Sunday night, but so much happens during the day. But before we get to my panel of guests, this fabulous panel, I want to remind everyone that we begin every show and have for months now with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings in the fall of 2019. I don't know how many of you got to see his piece, but he actually wrote a piece in the Washington Post just this week. The title, it was August 1st, actually Saturday. Alexander Vindman writes, "Coming forward ended my career. I still believe doing what's right matters." All right, that's the title. I'm going to attach it on our Facebook page so that you can see it. But I wanted to share just two or three sentences from his piece because they relate directly to the part that we pulled out from his testimony. He says, "During my testimony in the House impeachment inquiry, I reassured my father, who experienced Soviet authoritarianism firsthand, saying, 'Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.' Despite Trump's retaliation, I stand by that conviction. Even as I experienced the low of ending my military career, I've also experienced the loving support of tens of thousands of Americans, including moi. Theirs is a chorus of hope that drowns out the spurious attacks of a disreputable man and his sycophants. Since the struggle of our nation's independence, America has been a union of purpose, a union born from the belief that although each individual is the pilot of their own destiny, when we come together, we change the world. We are stronger as a woven rope than as an unbound thread." Now, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. I am so proud that we have been doing this for months. Again, I want to remind everyone, I want the voice of a patriot ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise, whether it's in person, whether it's absentee, or whether it's vote by mail. Now, Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Rethink the week. So much happens, it feels like rethink a year, but it's only been a week. Joining us, as he does virtually almost every week, is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. He is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back to the program, Dean.
Hi, Ernie. Good to be with you.
It's a pleasure. Stephen Pimpare. Stephen Pimpare is a specialist in poverty and homelessness and all those things that we're now going to be facing on steroids because we have not re-upped the unemployment benefits, because we've decided that people can begin the evictions right now in the middle of a pandemic, despite the fact that we see enormous unemployment and the hugest crash in the GDP ever in American history. Stephen Pimpare not only has that level of expertise, he's also a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Ernie.
Bob Hennelly. Every time I read anything that you write, whether it's at InsiderNJ or Salon.com or at Stuck Nation or at The Chief Leader, I feel like my pen and your pen are attached because I'm going, I could have written that, but I just don't have the time and you do it so much better than me. Let me welcome Bob Hennelly back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So much is happening, even just today. I just mentioned that I watched, you know, the dragon come down, and I'm still so excited. I can remember being at Camp Betsy Cox in Pittsford, Vermont, when we landed a man on the moon, and it was the first time they brought a television set to camp. It was just incredible. And here I am, 66 years old, it's 2020, and I'm still glued going, I wonder if I would have been an astronaut. But that's not the big story. The big story actually is a story about the Republican convention. And we know that there are really incredible outbreaks of COVID everywhere. And I'll start with you, Dean Spiliotis. The other story that just broke this afternoon, Sunday, was the fact that Governor Abbott has just announced that although he is leading the Republican delegation to the Republican convention, he ain't going. And of course, he used the excuse, which is a valid excuse, that he has to be on the ground dealing with COVID. Part of the problem is the reason there's a spike in Texas is because they reopened too soon. And while he was on the ground, he was sort of MIA, missing in action. And now he's terrified because he knows he has the largest percentage of uninsured in the country. He has a significant number of undocumented immigrants who are afraid to access not only hospitals, but anything in the way of benefits. He's seeing a huge spike, and he has the little governor, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, basically saying he doesn't listen to Fauci, and it's fine to go back into the economy, because after all, if we're 70 and we die, who cares? We can be sacrificed. That's Dan Patrick. So isn't it interesting, though, that Governor Abbott is not going? I'm sort of curious, Dean Spiliotis, as to how you read the tea leaves on that.
Yeah, well, it'll now be interesting to see if there is a domino effect similar to what we saw for when they were going to have the convention in Florida, and one by one, Republican members of Congress and others said they weren't going to be there, if that's going to happen again now with North Carolina. To be honest, at this point, I'm confused as to what there actually is going to be on the ground. We don't really even know. Everything is so fluid. You know, Trump throws curveballs every other day, and so it could be something new or something different. But, you know, the reality is we now know that these large kinds of events, particularly when people don't wear masks, are super spreader events. There's no denying that now. We saw that very tragic loss of Herman Cain, whatever you thought of his politics. That was a very sad
666
situation. 999.
Oh, 999. Oh, well, I mixed it up. They look the same. They look the same. 999, 666.
666 thing, six is a very different thing.
Right? Quite a different number.
That's right. Maybe that's why I was thinking of it. Sorry.
So, you know, we don't know necessarily that he got it at Tulsa, but the timing is very suspect. But regardless, these kind of events, we now know what the outcome typically is. Plus, as you mentioned, the governor is dealing with a very difficult situation in Texas. There's been a few glimmers of hope in the last couple of days, but I've read some of the coverage of, you know, rural parts of the state, particularly in southern part of Texas, where these towns, heavily Latino, are just getting wiped out by the virus. And as we know, a lot of these lower income towns are multi-generational families living in close spaces. They don't have good health care. It's a real humanitarian disaster that he's dealing with. So I think the combination of what he's dealing with in Texas, the fact that we don't even really know what we're going to see at the Republican convention, and the well-documented medical risk you take, all of those things, I think, we'll see now if we see a domino effect with other VIPs.
Well, I'm going to stay in the Lone Star State, Steve, and I'm going to go to Louis Gohmert. Oh, my God. He blamed the mask on getting COVID. And I want to remind everyone, he's a congressman from where? From Texas. And now he walked around, you know, Congress not wearing a mask. He would go into his office. He would basically shame people who were wearing masks. He insisted that his staff come into the friggin' office, even though they weren't, you know, being discouraged from wearing a mask. And now another member, I believe it's a Democratic member, who serves on the committee with him, has now contracted COVID and is out of his mind, because I believe that individual is an older individual, which is basically everybody in Congress, except for maybe AOC and a handful of the new folks. But it's very, very interesting, because this is now beginning to not just hurt, it is beginning to really sort of go into the halls of power. and we're beginning to see people being affected. And these are people who have all the assets that they you don't see in virtually every city and town in Texas. They can protect themselves. They can be tested every 14 minutes if they want. So many things can happen, and yet they're contracting it, Steve.
I'll make the connection. I've been trying to make sense of Republican positioning around the latest discussions of the relief bill. And I think sort of conventional wisdom among most people is the best thing that both the president and Republicans can do to increase their electoral fortunes in November would be to work aggressively to get the virus under control and to shovel as much money as possible at people to minimize the harm, right? That would be sort of political science tells us that elected officials will act in their own electoral interest. And yet they are not, right? So I've been sort of trying to puzzle through, as have lots of people, as to what's going on, what are they on about? And I increasingly come to the conclusion that they are high on their own supply, right? That they have, what's the other expression, that they believe their own PR, right? And I think that this is sort of part of how we understand what's going on with Gohmert and with others, is that as objectively absurd as it is to anyone who pays even minimal attention, right? We know how to minimize the spread of the disease. We know how to limit its reach, right? Surely they can't possibly believe that this is not a real thing and it's all made up.
Well, let me just say something.
Numbers of them, I think, really do. They genuinely have locked themselves into such a deeply closed information loop that they are inflicting harm on themselves and, of course, on others, given the nature of the infection.
So Bob, you wrote this big piece about healthcare. So that's kind of reason why I sort of waited for you at the end. But let me just say something. And that is that in the beginning, according to my understanding, they thought that it was only going to happen with those blue states. They thought that COVID-19 identified partisanship and that it would only be in like the New Yorks and the Californias, and their peeps would be okay, Bob Henley. I mean, it's just incredible that they would even make that stupid assumption. And then you find out that Jared Kushner was in charge of testing. And what was the Vanity Fair piece? It went poof. Like, right. You know, the concept of testing, because Jared Kushner doesn't have a clue either. I am just so shocked at a nation that now realizes about how porous our healthcare system is, how incapable of responding because we don't have a public health structure,
right.
Of the fact that so many people are uninsured or underinsured or because it's connected to work, have no insurance now, that given with each passing hour, Bob, you see the level of vulnerability that you don't like step in and fill all those holes because the GOP is going to be dead, let alone not be able to sort of point to an economy or an election that they can win.
Unfortunately, they're going to take an inordinate number of civil servants and healthcare workers with them. Yes. I think that part of the problem here is that we do not have a public perception that matches the actual prognosis and nature of this disease. And so it's been framed as a binary: you either die or you survive it. And most Americans feel lucky. And so as a consequence, there's little attention to the research coming out of places like Berkeley, where they see, and this is in the piece, long-term coronary, respiratory, nervous system. So this thing has impacts on people that are, wait for it, asymptomatic. That's right, folks. You think you survived, it didn't touch you. You go to the doctor a couple of years later, and COVID came knocking and left fingerprints on your lungs. So it's more like we need to think about it like polio, that this is, we have to get beyond flattening the curve and think about a generation of disabled people on a scale we're not even talking about.
So, you know, it's interesting, Bob, because as you say that, you know what I'm thinking about immediately? This is going to sound awful because I don't even care about sports. Why would you play baseball? Why would you play football? Why would you play basketball? We're beginning to see that the spread in baseball, they can't control it. So you might survive as a baseball player after contracting COVID, but if you have an impact on your lungs. Right. If you have an impact, you can't play baseball for the rest of your life. So here, Dean Spiliotis, they trained, they treated their bodies like temples, and now they're willing to play a game where it's shown that they can't stop the spread, even with the millions and millions of dollars and everyone being washed down and everything else, they're still getting it. Dean, if we aren't sort of come to Jesus moment by seeing what's happening with our sports team, and if they can't control it, then it starts making you realize, how do you control it for schools? How do you control it for colleges? How do you control it within the workplace? If they can't, what are we doing, Dean?
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing that right here in New England with the Red Sox, the pitcher basically out for the rest of the year because he has a heart inflammation as a result of having had COVID. And, you know, what you just mentioned, Arnie, that's a legitimate financial calculation. If you're an elite athlete and you may survive asymptomatically just fine initially, but if you lose some percentage of lung capacity or cardiopulmonary capacity, you're literally talking losing millions and millions of dollars of earnings on your career. So you are seeing, not only for family reasons, but also for personal reasons, a number of athletes in a variety of sports sitting the year out. Now, we are seeing that the NHL hockey playing up in Canada in two bubbles, and then the NBA playing down at Disney World in one bubble, they're having a lot more success. The problem with baseball, and I think we're also going to see it with football, is they're not in a bubble. They're coming and going from being out there in the world, and that's just, it makes it almost impossible to control infection the way you can with the NBA and with the NHL.
So did I read this right, Stephen? I heard it and I should have checked before we went on the air. My understanding is, you know, so they're still fighting over the extra $600. They're too rich. It's too much money. I just want to remind everyone once again that the $600 is the equivalent of $15 an hour for 40-hour work week. That's really what the $600 a week is. So for a lot of restaurant workers who earn under the minimum wage and who earn tips, this is like crucial, given what they would have collected on unemployment anyway, Stephen. I mean, it's just amazing to me. And as someone's pointed out, most of the people that are getting this extra $600 are living in places where their current rent, if they're able to pay it, it's probably 30, 40, or 50% of their income at a minimum, because they're living in a place where affordability has always been a challenge. So as I'm looking at this issue, I am thinking that this also is a super spreader event. That it's not just the GOP convention, it's not just large events, but if people aren't able to get that extra 600, if evictions are now back on the table, if we are now looking at hurricanes, and they're actually saying in Florida, thank God they may have, you know, dodged a bullet, but they didn't want people to come into a shelter, which is what they would normally do, because they're afraid that the shelters become super spreader events. I am looking at evictions, and that's another super spreader event. So if we're trying to tap something down, what the government just did by its inaction is actually stimulate the spread.
And, you know, at this point, you really do have to wonder whether they really do have interest in tamping it down. Treasury Secretary this morning or yesterday, in talking about his opposition to the extended $600 a month unemployment benefits, said, well, you know, we're paying people to stay home. It's like, well, yes, it's a pandemic and there are no jobs. Yes, that's precisely what we're doing. And it's, you know, and part of it is, again, you know, does he hear himself is sort of the at least sort of since Reagan era ideology, right, that the way in which you deal with the economy is rich people need incentives, but poor people need punishments, right? That it's carrots for rich people, but sticks for poor people, right? Have they so internalized that notion? Are they so genuinely worried about deficits, right? Which the Great Depression in Keynes tells us should be the very last thing on our list of concerns right now, right? Have they so bought into all of this utterly unfounded, discredited conservative economic ideology that they really don't see that keeping that $600 going is going to help keep the stock market going and keep money going to their rich friends, right? So if that's still what they're worried about, they could act in their own interest and still give money to all those terrible unemployed people. It's so very frustrating, right? Because this is an instance in which their own narrow electoral interests align with doing what is right for vulnerable populations, and they are fighting it tooth and nail.
So, you know, Bob, as I'm thinking about the $600 being too much, I posted it on Facebook. I said, you know, we don't really even understand what a billion looks like. And so I used this number where I said 1 million, you know, if it was by seconds, would take you about 11 days. 1 billion by seconds would take you about 32 years. Okay? That's how much bigger a billion is than a million. We don't even comprehend it. And then I reminded everyone that Jeff Bezos made $13 billion in one day, Bob. And I kept thinking, God, he must have been working really hard that day.
I would say that the thing that we still have to account for is that there is a belief on the right wing in this herd immunity. And so part of it is they are still driven by this Malthusian calculation that you can get through it, a certain number of people will die. And as David Frum pointed out, and it's of the demographic, they think it's gonna be voters, mostly Democratic voters, as you alluded to. So there's really, they see this as a natural event. And as the Lieutenant Governor of Texas pointed out, this is just paying the price to advance the American circumstance. And so with that, and the science is very clear on this, that they did this random survey of some 16,000 people for antibodies, and they've come to this understanding that they really don't know that such a thing exists in terms of immunity, and if it does exist, how long it exists. And when you factor in what the implications are of letting this rip in terms of long-term disability, it shows us we need to be in this conservative lockdown mode where the economic policy should inform a unified central public national policy, which is non-existent. We're still in the situation of the states fending for themselves.
Well, you know, but Bob, one of the things that really bothers me about all this is that, so they're stuck in two places. They believe that government isn't the answer to anything, that the private sector is the answer to everything. But the private sector can't handle this. And it's clear they can't handle it. So you've got a private sector that can't be responsive. You've got a government sector that's run by Donald Trump and his cronies, and they somehow have checked out. And then they're blaming, you know, those that are unemployed for somehow, you know, sucking off the government teat because they want that extra $600 in unemployment. And you know what I would have done? I would have done a split screen and talked about sort of those people that are earning more with the $600 than they would have earned with their paycheck, so they're not going back to work. And I would have reminded them, who took us to our economic knees, Bob Hennelly, in 2008? What kind of earnings did they have?
Exactly.
How many billions did they make? Who did they shaft? How many people lost their homes? Why? For no other reason than you had the people on Wall Street who basically, you know, played Russian roulette with the economy, and we bailed them out.
And they got, the concentration of wealth has continued under both parties.
Yes.
And it's accelerating now. It's the point now that Democrats need to be speaking about an excess profit tax. I mean, it's time to be balancing the ledger here, because what's happening is Mr. Bezos is having a once in a century windfall. And the price for that, he's socializing the cost and privatizing the profit. And we saw that with that hearing where the big tech giants came forward, and they are the robber barons. And the level of arrogance and the role of campaign funding in keeping them insulated from just basic civic participation. I mean, we really need to change this conversation. We're thinking too small, and excess profits has to be where we go next.
So since you did that, I'm going to end with you, Dean Spiliotis, because I'm at the point right now where I even said, so why do we even have billionaires? So if you had $760 million as opposed to a billion, what couldn't you buy? How many houses would you not own? Could you not buy that Picasso? I'm just sort of curious. But we're talking about people that have $10 billion, $12 billion, $50 billion. People who are, they just said that the wealthy since March, between March and now, that these billionaires have seen their incomes rise by about $500 billion. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money as people are squawking about an extra $600. And I am just wondering, what have we done with capitalism that have so distorted it that it isn't about competition. It isn't about sort of understanding the need of an economy to actually have a strong working base. It's all now sucked up to the top. And during the time of a pandemic, if I were a billionaire, I'd say, take my money. I'd rather have an economy than, you know, die like with the whole story of King Midas. You know, he touched his daughter and she turned to gold. You know, in the end, it wasn't worth it. And in a way, what they're doing is they're touching the United States and it's hardening like concrete. And you can't make money on concrete.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that increasingly it seems sometimes like the market, stock market, is really untethered from the reality of what's going on the ground for most people. And you know, in the grand scheme of our economy, the number of people who are invested in the market is pretty small compared to all you know, wage earners and workers. So yeah, you have this sort of odd scenario that, on the face of it, where you know the economy is in real deep trouble, yet people are experiencing rapidly increasing wealth, which seems counterintuitive. You know, if we do get a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president, you'll probably see some attempt at some sort of billionaire tax or a tax on the top 0.5% of income earners, which is a, you know, very small group of very wealthy individuals. Some of those folks said they would certainly be open to that. Others have not said as much. But yeah, it just seems like stuff is kind of distorted. How you redress that in a way that isn't spun very negatively in a capitalist society in which even people who aren't wealthy aspire one day to be wealthy. That's part of our kind of national story. I think that's going to be the challenge.
So I need to end this half of the conversation. It's our Rethink the Week. Dean Spiliotto, Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Pimper from UNH Manchester, and of course, Robert Hennelly, Bob Hennelly from Salon.com, from The Chief Leader, from Insider NJ. Anyway, he's a prolific writer at Stuck Nation. All right, when we come back, we have to talk about guns, all kinds of stories about guns, Portland guns, maybe Sturm Ruger guns, but we'll talk about guns. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day striking Teamsters in Minneapolis defied martial law. They stopped scab trucks, forcing the release of their strike leaders. Armed with bayonets and machine guns, the National Guard had patrolled the streets for nearly a week. They seized scores of strikers and union leaders and threw them into military stockades. Drivers were outraged. They defied Governor Olson and Major General Walsh, who, on behalf of the Citizens Alliance and trucking bosses, were determined to break the strike. Soon after strikers were imprisoned, drivers began chasing scab trucks across the city. Multiple reports poured in of picketers forcing trucks to stop. Some unloaded their cargo onto bridges. Others chased, captured, and damaged the scab trucks. Strikers ripped ignition wires out, forced scabs from the wheel, and then disappeared before police and the National Guard could arrive to retaliate. In just 3 hours, strikers had overturned nearly 70 trucks. Unable to stop the superior force of striking drivers, Bill Brown, Vincent, and Miles Dunn were ordered unconditionally released from the military stockades. Now, employers, the governor, and other strike-breaking agencies were eager to propose peace to federal mediators. But they proposed to scrap the terms of their earlier May agreement. In response, the leaders of Local 574 issued a general strike call. In it, they asked, quote, "Is there one man so blind as not to see that if 574 is allowed to go down to defeat under the brutal hammering of military despotism, the whole labor movement of the city will have been dealt a mortal blow? Union men, brothers, sisters, fellow workers, what are you going to do about it? We appeal to you for solidarity." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Now let's get the kids and pack up the car. Take that vacation we've been waiting for. Drive across this country, leave our worries far behind. Singing four-part harmony. And we'll visit friends and sights along the way. So bring the bikes and toys and diapers, pay the neighbor's sons, and call to stop the mail, and honey, don't forget the guns. Don't forget the guns, stop for the night. Hope for good weather, hope the kids don't fight. They've never seen Mount Rushmore and they ought to understand the kind of men who forged our freedom all across this land. We'll hike up a trail and ride down the stream, stand by Old Faithful and watch her blow off steam. When we pack big, big lunches, that's not all we'll bring along, 'cause we'll be packing 45s case anything goes wrong. Now don't forget the guns, you know exactly what I mean. Bring the pistols, bring the Uzi and the old AR-15. We don't look for trouble, but by golly, if we're in it, it's nice to know we're free to blow.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and our producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We are joined by Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Pimper of the Carsey Institute in UNH Manchester, and Robert Hennelly, Salon.com, Chief Leader, Insider NJ, and at Stuck Nation. So I'm going to go to you, Stephen Pimper. And I saw a story. I want to talk about guns, but this is a story that it's a terrible story, but it just kind of made me laugh. Here it is. Florida man arrested for enforcing social distancing by firing shots in hotel lobby. This is unbelievable. According to police, Douglas Marks, 29, has a curious method for reinforcing social distancing. After he spotted people without masks, he allegedly fired four warning shots at the Crystal Beach Suites Hotel. The criminal charges contained one interesting element. While Marks did not reportedly aim at anyone, he was still charged with assault. This follows an incident in California where a woman maced a couple who was eating with their child at a park without masks. This is getting crazy, Stephen Pimper. This is getting crazy. First of all, we know we have too many guns. First of all, we're not using our mouth. We're not using words. Remember when you were a child, when your mother would say, don't hit, use words. Don't hit, use words. Now I have a country that everybody's like, you know, equipped with some kind of ammo and gun. And now I'm saying, don't shoot, use words. But this is sort of an interesting story, but it sort of says where the tension is that we have no policy. People are not knowing who to trust. And Donald Trump is in some ways almost reinforcing this divide on masks, on the use of guns, on all the fear. And we're seeing it playing out in this hotel in Florida. Stephen?
I think there are about 17 sort of things that emerge from thinking about that. The first is, as you pointed out, that we are, as a nation, so horrifically awash in guns. That is at the root of so many of the problems. If you think about some of the dilemmas as people think about reorienting, defunding, shifting police forces across the country, this becomes one of the central challenges, right? Is that when exceedingly large portions of the citizenry is armed, you do need to think about that, right? In terms of how you are able to respond in kind. But the other thing that I think this also brings up that for my money anyway, in looking at coverage of the ongoing pandemic and the financial crisis is the enormous toll that this is taking on mental health across large numbers of populations in lots and lots of different ways. I think that in some ways that we are all collectively in the midst of this sustained traumatic event and made worse by the fact that we are, of course, isolated, right? So even many of the ways in which we would tend to our own mental health under ordinary circumstances or under extraordinary circumstances, right, that also limits it, right? So this is not to excuse people who use guns in ways that they should not use guns, but it's also perfectly understandable, right? Guns are everywhere. They're super easy to get. And we are suffering this awful collective trauma, and some people are going to react in other ways. The last piece of this is, as you pointed out, the ways in which the President of the United States, the Attorney General, and the Secretary of Homeland Security are in themselves stoking violence, fostering violence, inciting violence. We saw this really clearly in Portland, right? The minute DHS walked away, peaceful protests resumes, and all the chaos, supposedly, that was taking place in Portland was nowhere to be found.
So Bob, we interviewed a really wonderful transgender woman who's been on the streets of Portland for 60 days. So she's been covering it from the streets. And she said what was so interesting was that when the feds showed up to bring about stability, to protect the federal buildings from graffiti, she noticed two things. A group of people who had been sort of supportive of what they saw, but would never have gotten involved and never gone onto the streets of Portland, suddenly they came out too because they were so offended, Bob, by the fact that the feds had shown up. They were like, this is too much. This is an authoritarian move. This is what you see in places like Germany. And so the numbers increased when the feds show up with a group of people that normally never do these kinds of things. So she was saying, Arnie, it was just incredible to see this even more diverse mix of people in support of each other. And then one of the things that she also said, Bob, which was so interesting, is you know how they wanted to protect the federal courthouses? Well, they were protecting the federal courthouses from what? From graffiti. But what were they doing? They were using, you know, they were putting gas in the air. What's that? What's the stuff they spray? You can't breathe. Tear gas. Thank you so much. I can speak the words. So they were spreading tear gas and all these kinds of things. The federal judge had to shut the courthouse down because the feds had used so much tear gas, Bob, that they couldn't function in the building, and the building was consumed by the gas that they had to shut the building down. So the feds, which were trying to protect this courthouse, ultimately had the courthouse shut down because of their behavior.
Well, to me, I wrote incredible about this in the sense that this is a sign of authoritarianism when illegal, unconstitutional, and oppressive measures are used to protect the symbols. Meanwhile, two Sundays ago here in New Jersey, the 20-year-old son of a sitting federal court judge was shot and killed by a Trumpophile who had tormented this sitting judge, first Latina judge in New Jersey, appointed by President Obama. This young man was killed in broad daylight. In the case of an actual assassination, we had in Oakland, Patrick Underwood, who was protecting the Ron Dellums Courthouse in the middle of civil protest and unrest in Oakland, African-American DHS uniformed officer, killed by a right-wing, allegedly active duty staff sergeant of the Air Force with the Boogaloo Boys. So it goes much deeper than that. The places where we're seeing actual violence is this right-wing stuff that Trump has created a climate for. We've seen threats against judges go from around 900 to 4,500 in the last few years.
Oh my God. I mean, it's, and you just wrote, and I want to sort of continue on this sort of gun theme, unfortunately. And that is that you sent me a piece about sort of the rise in sales of guns and ammunition. And it was so ironic that you would send me this literally 13 seconds before I had just posted on Facebook, Sturm Ruger, one of the biggest producers of weapons in the United States, if not in the world, was happy but complaining that they claim because of COVID-19, that was what he said, they're seeing a huge spike in the sale of guns that they can't keep up with. Now, my question is, what does COVID-19 have to do with the sale of guns? I mean, you can't shoot the virus. So I'm kind of curious.
Well, I thought Stephen very eloquently described this unprecedented stress that's happened collectively on the population. And when I did some Vox interviewing people who were applying for gun permits in New Jersey, which is not easy to do, I ran into a young mother, healthcare professional, who told me that she was concerned. She watched Fox News about the fact that the rioters and looters were going to come to Brick Township, New Jersey. Because she was zeroing in on the footage out of Portland, which is exactly what Donald Trump wanted her to do. Right. And so I think Stephen really hooks into what's happening. And this is something that we really need to be conscious of. And to some degree, MSNBC falls into the same track. Like, I'm kind of amazed. Portland was considered to be a place that was eccentric, that was representative of absolutely nothing in America at one time except surreal comedy. Now all of a sudden it's become the epicenter and emblematic of street conditions. I mean, I'm a reporter in a city that was posting 2,100 homicides when I started back in the 70s, the bad old days. And still, even with the unfortunate spike we've seen, it's still below levels people can't believe in the context of that higher death rate. So it's this, the fact that we aren't getting out, and what we see is distorted images by a media that is driving a propaganda machine both on the right and the left.
And Ken, you want to weigh in here, but one of the things I just want to sort of put a button on with what Bob said is that, remember, one of the themes that we're hearing coming out of this president is he's talking to the suburban housewives. That woman that you sort of interviewed, Bob, you know, who said that she, you know, wanted to get a, she was worried that Portland was going to come to her community and that she needed to be armed for this. Right. And I'm trying to figure out who she's going to shoot. But again, all these things are playing out. So if you're watching Fox and you're listening to the president, then you're not getting the whole picture. And he's playing this thing, you know, I'm going to protect you in your home. They're coming for you. They're going to move into your neighborhood. Of course, part of what he's thinking is they're going to buy a house. And what she's thinking is they're going to bring their guns. And it's just it's incredible that it's like it's a 1950s story, you know, framed in 2020, but it's so much more lethal than anything we could have possibly imagined, because he's adding every single fear and compounding it. Ken?
I just wanted to add one other travesty to make us even more worried. Because obviously what everyone's talking about is exactly right and worthy of worrying about. And I perked up when Bob mentioned not only the actual federal troops in Portland, but also the Boogaloo Trump supporter who murdered Judge Salas's son, because those dots have to be connected. The fact is that Trump and his administration are, and have been, I think, trying to unite his federal goons with the Boogaloo boys and the private goons. You can go back to Charlottesville or before, but certainly now, came out last month that ICE, the immigration enforcement agents who go through the streets and round people up and deport them, has tried to start a program which they call Citizen Academies, which is a nice, easygoing name, but it's more than Citizen Academies. They are handpicking members of the public to recruit who will join with them and learn from them how ICE officers go about
identifying,
rounding people up, enforcing the immigration laws, and taking people in to deport them. So it's not just the crazy nut in New Jersey who's a Boogaloo boy and murders the son of a federal judge. And it's not only the federal troops in Portland, but I believe that they're trying to work together, and that is even scarier. Whether they work together sub rosa or known to the public, something we really have to worry about.
So Dean, the thing that scares me about all of this, and this is really what we saw in Portland, and I think there was some significant pushback by the Republicans finally, but what we saw in Portland were people that were dressed like they were authority, but didn't identify which authority. They didn't have the names, their patrolman name. They didn't have the division they were with. They were wearing camouflage. They looked like something you might see, you know, on the streets of someplace in Afghanistan. And they felt, but what scares me about this is that anybody can dress up like this. I do it on Halloween, okay? But the problem is now, if this is going to be pervasive around the country, and we are going to blend cops with, you know, ICE that's identifying themselves, or Border Patrol that identifies themselves, and then these other groups that are maybe part of Donald Trump's, you know, team, or maybe it's guys that are dressing up like they're part of Donald Trump's team. Yeah. Dean, how do you know? This is terrifying, is that they're now blending in, and I don't know what my rights are, because I don't know who's stopping me.
Yeah, it's very scary to have everything be so opaque. There's no accountability. You don't have any way to assess whether the proper rules and regulations are being followed for detaining people. You know, the unmarked rental cars was a particularly frightening visual. The whole thing just felt like you were watching, you know, sort of authoritarian countries with these you know, unmarked stormtroopers, just sort of acting with impunity. And you know, the problem, part of the, it's not a problem, but part of what makes it so frustrating is that kind of Trump's reasons or tactical reason for doing this, or what his enterprise is, that's pretty transparent. So you have the opaqueness of the actual forces, exactly, and of the kind of legal process, combined with this really kind of transparent attempt to scare people into voting for him.
So let me just say something, because Stephen, as I'm listening to this, we did a phenomenal interview with the guys from pogo.org, which looks at government accountability, and they wrote this piece about the demilitarization of police. And when you actually look at those police, not the guys that are not identified, they kind of look like military. Our cops are looking more and more like they're part of the US Army, or they're, you know, and then you've got, you know, the other, I mean, I don't even know where I am anymore. I mean, because that's what's so terrifying, because as we militarize the police, they took on the trappings of an army. And when you take on the trappings of an army, you basically look at me as the enemy. You don't look at me as a constituent.
So, I mean, I don't for a minute diminish the danger of what it is that we are seeing in places like Portland, but I also think that this is one of those places where a little historical memory is useful. I taught for whatever 20 years in New York City. It was not at all unusual for a young black male student to be abducted by people who said that they were officers of the law, thrown into an unmarked van, and hauled off and retained for some extended period of time, right? This is in lots of ways not new. It is new to white America, right? Mm-hmm. But these are practices that have been ramping up, particularly in black centers of large cities, for decades now. And there's a strain of radical black thought that has been trying to warn us for many, many years now, that the risk is that this is the site where the state practices more repressive authoritarian activities, and that they will inevitably spread out and affect populations who think they are immune to that kind of state suppression.
Yeah, and Arnie, let me jump in for a minute, because that was what, as Steve was talking, I was thinking, yeah, this has actually been going on for a while. You know, I lived in Chicago for many years and saw the beginnings of the militarization of police forces. And what you would hear from the police, I mean, this is what they would argue, is that they were being outgunned, that the quote, bad guys had semi-automatic weapons, you know, grenade launchers, you know, sort of the other types of weaponry, and that they needed to up armor as a result. But you've seen that kind of philosophy trickle down into increasingly small, you know, municipal police forces, where they've given access to surplus equipment from the federal government, and so now everybody's got tactical vehicles and all the sort of trappings that go along with being increasingly militarized. But yeah, Steve's right. This has been building for many years.
I know. Ken, you want to weigh in quick?
Yes, just one quick point. If you don't think white people are subject to this too, think about 1964 and the civil rights workers in Mississippi. And it actually, Stephen, it happened to many, many African Americans before the public took notice. But once it started happening to white people, all of a sudden the public was interested. But the fact of the matter is that the Boogaloo Boys of the 1960s were the Ku Klux Klan, and they would abduct people and just put them in unmarked vehicles.
And the Klan was often, remember, indistinguishable from the sheriff's office, right?
Yeah. And then
the citizens' councils were often the local sheriff.
And then the sheriff's offices would work with them. They would arrest some black person who was making trouble by speaking out. They would release the person at a time that the Klan knew they were going to be there, and then the Klan unofficially and lynch them.
Oh, God. All right. So, Bob, there's so many other stories we have to talk about. So I looked at Ed Notes online, and they said, is the National Day of Action for Safe Schools, August 3rd, which will be the day this show airs, a precursor to a nationwide teacher strike? Now, you do a lot when it comes to public employees because right. you report for the chief leader. We've been talking a lot about the folks that are the frontline workers. One of the reasons why I'm so freaked out about school is with each passing day, we're learning more and more. And one of the things that we keep forgetting is that this is a disease that spread. It's an aerosol disease. It's spread through the air. And when you talk about school, almost more than any other setting, you're talking about a diverse group of children coming from very, very different backgrounds, coming into a small confined area with a teacher who usually tends to be older, and there isn't a lot of extra space. A lot of these schools are really old, so they have really crap ventilation. Some of them can't even open their windows. I mean, you're looking at this toxic brew that you were creating, and we're calling it a school, Bob. Well, and it's just, to me, it's just so shocking that we're not, that we're somehow still forcing the idea of opening as if somehow, because a five-year-old won't die, the five-year-old could bring it home and everybody else could.
One of the preconditions of our COVID circumstance is the scandal that has unraveled, that shows this poor status of school public health. While we were spending hundreds of billions of borrowed money to project force all over the world on our never-ending war on terrorism, we were rolling back basic public health. So as NPR reported over the weekend, I think one in four schools does not have a school nurse. 40% share one. So that's what we have flying into this. We have closed urban and rural hospitals, and we were rewarded with declining life expectancy 3 years in a row. So we were hurting before the pandemic set foot here.
Well, and not only that, Bob, but I look at my state that had a moratorium on helping to contribute to, you know, repairing schools or building new schools. So which schools are going to be the schools that have horrific ventilation? Which schools are not going to have sufficient space to accommodate their students? So again, the inequality piece is going to be grotesque. I remember once going down, Amherst, New Hampshire is a very, very wealthy community. And I had never been to Amherst, but I finally went because I was running for governor. And I walked into their relatively new school. This is years ago, but I went to the new school. This is the early 1990s. And I'm like, indoor piazzas. I'm looking at the cafeteria that looked like a bistro, you know? And
I'm thinking,
so I'm thinking, I could go to college here. And this was their high school. And I had a high school in my little town of Orford, New Hampshire we had moguls in our gym. I mean, there was no flat floor, let alone anything else. So you're right, a lot of these things were precursors. None of these existed before. But now what COVID does is that it intensifies the sort of the problem. But even in wealthy schools, Bob, we're finding out that where little Baron Trump goes to school,
right,
they're having problems with COVID. So even the very, very affluent don't know how to deal with it, and they have all the money in the world. Think about the rest of us.
Exactly. And I do think that this is an opportunity. My concern is that we really need right now, because of the scale of this disease, to take the fight into the community. Right now, we're very hospital-centric. And if you look at Cuba's performance, right, they've gone door to door with 8.3 physicians per 1,000 compared to our 2-point-something. They have gone after this disease with a vengeance in the community, because that's where it is. And they have 87 deaths so far.
All right. So, Stephen, I got to end with the fact that there is politics here. And there is going to be an election in November, and we've got Joe Biden, and we had the John Lewis funeral, which was just incredible. But what was so remarkable to me, as someone pointed out, was Bill Clinton's talk. Not because I liked it, but because Bill Clinton basically sort of thanked Obama and Clyburn for settling
knocking Sanders out of the race.
Yes, yes.
Either before or after, I can't remember, he misnamed Stokely Carmichael and misread that history and talked trash about him. So Clinton was being Clinton.
I was so shocked that this was happening at the funeral. And I'm again, this is part of the problem as we go into November, is that you want to bring all kinds of folks into the election booth because we're going to need a huge number. But then when you see what Clinton does in the middle of this such a reverential event like John Lewis's funeral, you keep thinking, do I like this party? I have to tell you, Stephen.
Well, maybe this will give you some comfort, right? Is that right. That Clinton was at the center of the party when he was president. He is far outside the core of the party now. The party has moved well beyond Clinton.
That's true. Right. And Dean Spiliotis, who's currently a Republican, but he was formerly a Democrat. He was just in The Hill being quoted that the Democratic Party used to be so moderate. I don't know what happened to the Democratic. He's left the party, by the way, and he became a Republican. He just won his primary, but he just didn't understand. He used to be such a moderate party, and I'm thinking, and he joined the Republican Party. And I'm going, what do you call the party you're joining now? I mean, if the Democrats are no longer moderate, what's your definition of the GOP? And that's really how I want to end, Dean. What is the GOP going to be like if Trump loses? How do they regroup?
Well, I don't know that they'll be, I mean, if you listen to what a lot of conservatives are saying, if you listen to the Never Trumpers, the Lincoln Project, the Republicans against voters against Trump, they all talk about starting over and building a new party that is slightly right of center. Their argument is that the Republican Party no longer really exists and that they're going to have to start over. And so I don't know if you want to call that moderate, but they talk about that the country needs that they would like to rebuild a slightly right of center party. Well, you know, we'll see if they can do it. But part of it will depend on whether a lot of the Republicans in Congress who have been quiet for the last couple of years suddenly find their voice again.
I don't think so. And on that note, I want to thank Stephen Pimper, Dean Spiliotis, Robert Hennelly, and my producer, Ken Barnes, for our Rethink the Week. If something should happen Sunday night, we'll talk about it on Tuesday. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.